Well, welcome to day two. I just want to take a quick moment this morning. I was going to do this last night and everyone was having such a good time. I didn't want to interrupt. But I want to take a quick moment and acknowledge all of the people that helped make this meeting possible in terms of working on the agenda and all of the details. And I want to start with the person in our office who has been working on this meeting for over the last year. And she's just done an absolutely tremendous job. Liz Thompson, who is the director of our research and scientific affairs. She's done an amazing job and really does deserve our gratitude. So thank you, Liz. And Liz is going to come up and do a quick thank you to the committee that she worked with this year to put the meeting together and the agenda together.
Thank you all for being so responsive to all the communication. I'd really like to recognize the committee, Dr. Bill Isakoff, Dr. Daphna Barsaji, Dr. Jeff Wall, Dr. Ron Evans, and Dr. Inder Verma. There were a lot of other people that we spoke with along the way, and thank you for your patience and your wonderful input. Yesterday was terrific. Today promises to be even just as good, without any slights to the folks from yesterday. And just a couple of housekeeping pieces today. For those of you who are flying out, we have departure notices and departure information. So just as you had a travel service bring you to the property, we also have someone who will take you back to the airport or wherever you're going. So please check in with Jennifer Hall at the hospitality desk so we can kind of move that through. Tonight, we're having dinner at the Menge Museum. The museum will be closed to the public. It's going to be a very special event. When we arrive, we'll have a glass of wine, wander around, look at some of the fabulous exhibits, have dinner, and then have a brief lecture. It'll just be a tremendous evening. We're hoping that all of you are coming. If you are attending the meeting and we knew that you were traveling with a partner or spouse, we did include that person. If you've made other plans or are not planning to join us, please let Jennifer Hall know at the break so that we can change some of our arrangements. And finally, a little change in the schedule today. We will be having Roger Bingham join us today as our moderator, and we're really delighted that he'll be here. Where are you, Roger? Most of you have seen him. He's a good-looking gentleman who had a black jacket on and a black shirt yesterday. Today he has a black jacket in it. There he is. So we'll be delighted to have Roger's expertise moving us through some of the question periods. But for now, let's move right to the agenda. Dr. Barbasid.
You want to say something? Well, I was just going to, not the one ever needs to correct Liz, but I was going to correct her that today is going to be better than yesterday. not as good. So since we are already late, and I don't think Dr. Barbasid or Dr. Verma need any introductions, they certainly will dwarf me, the dwarfest of all, so we can get started.
Thanks a lot. Okay, good morning. First of all, I would like to thank Inder and Ron and Jeff and the rest of the people, PanCamp, for the invitation to allow me to be here with you today. As now it's becoming a must, I'm going to disclose some information. First, I have no financial relationships. This is more important. I'm not an expert on pancreatic cancer, nor on pancreas biology, so I will not take any hard questions on these issues. In fact, the main interest of my laboratory is to understand the role of RAS genes and of RAS oncogenes in an in vivo setting, and this is really the connection with pancreatic cancer because, as you know, and we already discussed it yesterday, even we don't know why, but at least I don't know why, KRAS is activated, is mutated in basically all PDAs. So, having made this disclosure, now let me introduce you to our model system, which is very, very similar to the one that Dave Tuberson and Tyler Jacks designed. In this, there are only two minor differences. One is that our mutation is the second most frequent mutation The G12D is the most frequent mutation in all human cancer. And then the other change is we introduce a color marker that is expressed in a bicistronic fashion, okay? And this, as you will see, allow us to identify at the single cell level those cells that express the KRAS oncogene when we turn it on, okay? Now, to turn on this, obviously we use the grease system because it requires removal of the stop cassette. To do that, we engineer a mouse. Actually, this is very similar to the ROSA 26, but at the time when I moved back to Spain from the States, the ROSA 26 with the CRIAT2 didn't exist yet. I called Phil Soriano. He told me he was making it, so there's no point making the same mouse. So we decided an alternative strategy, which is, again, to use the bicistronic strategy to express from a locus that must be expressed in all cells, which is the RNA, the large subunit of RNA polymerase 2, which, as you know, is responsible for making messenger RNA. So we assume that all cells make this enzyme and therefore make CRIART2. Now, these mice, when you put them together, nothing happens until you activate the inducible CRIART2 by giving 4-hydroxytamoxifen in a systemic fashion to the animal. Now, we generated these mice to actually ask perhaps a very crude question, but I was interested in finding in an in vivo setting how many tumors KRAS could induce. We already knew, obviously, that KRAS was present in human lung tumors, non-small lung adenocarcinomas, about 25%. We knew about colon adenocarcinomas, 50%, and we knew pancreatic adenocarcinomas, almost 90%. But the fact that an oncogene is not present, let's say in breast, doesn't mean that it cannot cause cancer in breast. So what we decided to do was to turn on the KRAS oncogene in all tissues, expecting to have cancers in basically all tissues, all organs. Now, this is just the way it works, that when you express one molecule of the mutant KRAS, you also express a molecule of a protein that has beta-galactosidase activity and give you a color marker. Okay, so when we did this experiment, it turned out that actually KRAS was expressed in all tissues, as we might expect from this strategy. And you can see here from the color, blue color, in various tissues, including pancreas. But these tissues were absolutely normal. Perhaps some of the most spectacular was this crypts in the colon, where the entire crypt is blue or not blue, indicating that actually we hit the stem cell, because otherwise it would be a chimeric crypt. And yet the crypt developed perfectly, harboring an oncogenic KRAS. So this was rather puzzling. In fact, the mice survived very well for up to 8 months with basically no symptoms, and then they start dying. And what they die is lung adenomas and adenocarcinomas. Actually, a tumor that had been already known to be induced by KRAS oncogene from the work of Dave Tuveson and Tyler Jacks, except in their system, they purposely turn on the KRAS oncogene in lung by using adenocree, and this was just turn it on everywhere, and only lung seemed to be a tissue that was able to become transformed as a consequence of KRAS activation. So we actually thought that perhaps by some sort of an stochastic mechanism, we were not turning on KRAS in too many cells. So one, a graduate student, I asked her to really push the system, and she treated the mice, in some cases, for up to 6 months with 4-hydroxytamoxifen. Perhaps hoping that perhaps the decree was not a very efficient. And this is almost what I can call a saturation level, because at that point afterwards, the mice start dying. And you can see it's still a mechanism that we don't understand. Some tissues, like colon, basically all the cells express the KRAS oncogene. With others, and interestingly, lung, which is the one in which the only place where actually the tumors happen, Only 20% of the cells are expressed. We cannot, we don't know whether this is really 4-hydroxytamoxifen getting to the cells or what is the reason, but this is the result. On the average, about half of the cells in this particular mouse or series of mice express a KRAS oncogene, and yet the mice only die of lung tumors, and we do not see tumors in other organs. Now, pancreas, as you can see, is here somewhere in the middle. About 35% of the cells express the KRAS oncogene. Now, this is just to show you, lung. Here, depending on the amount and time of 4-hydroxytamoxifen, as well as the how much time has elapsed since we start treatment, you can see either small adenocarcinomas or you can see full-blown carcinomas, and these mice will actually end up dying more of a breathing problem than actually the tumor itself. And now we are decreasing the amount of tamoxifen to just get only one tumor per lobule, and this is something you can do rather easily. Obviously, it takes longer. Now, this is just to show you a picture of the colon and the intestine. And the colon is quite remarkable. Now, basically, all CRIPs but two here are positive, and KRAS will not induce cancer in colon unless at least the systems we have tested, unless there is mutation of the APC locus in the animal. And we published that last year, collaboration with Alan Clark. Now, in the pancreas, we were really puzzled by, obviously, at this during all this work, we already knew the seminal work of Sunil and Dave, and we were really puzzled by the fact that, you know, with a very, very similar system, they were getting not only the whole spectrum of pinenes, but also the PDAs, and we were not getting anything. So I asked Carmen, I said, please look very, very carefully because, you know, these guys are getting tumors and we are not, and you need to look harder. So she actually took a series of mice and sectioned them every 5 microns, and she actually ended up finding some pinenes at very low, with very low frequency in the mice that have been treated for a long time with 4-hydroxytamoxifen. And I think we know now why these mice had these pinenes, and I think we can discuss that later. But certainly we never saw, or Carmen never saw, high-grade lesions or PDA in these mice. So what we did is then we tried to reproduce Sunil and Dave's data. By now, obviously, we couldn't do much more work with these mice because they were dying of lung cancer. So obviously, change in the strategy was to express the KRAS specifically in the pancreas. And to do that, we were lucky to get from Paul Grip and Eric Sandgren a transgenic system, which is a TETOF control CRE driven by the elastase promoter, which, as you heard yesterday from Steve, is expressed primarily in acinar cells, although some centroacinar cells also express this CRE. So obviously then, in this system, as long as we do not provide doxycycline, that means we don't have to do anything, then the elastase promoter is turned on at E16.5. So basically, I'm just going to go quickly through this because this was better explained by Steve yesterday. This is the range of cells in which, presumably, the KRAS oncogene is expressed in Dave Tuberson's model, and in ours is a much more limited range of expression, and also starting a little bit later. Anyway, the point, this has been published, is that now we can get exactly the same results that they were able to get, which is the full grade of pinenes, except, as was discussed yesterday, except for the fact that in this case, expression was limited to acinar and centroacinar cells. So since this was discussed yesterday, I don't think we need to labor a little more on the issue. Now, the fact that we can express the color marker gives us some additional information. For reasons that I guess had to do with the nature of the acinar cells, beta gal after it's being cleaved by the X gal after it's being cleaved by the beta galactosidase forms a precipitate, a blue precipitate that appears as a cytoplasmic dot. And this is unique to the acinar cells. In other cells, we get a uniform cytoplasmic level. But I think you can appreciate that there is a significant increase in the levels of KRAS expression, again, always using the beta-galactosidase activity as a surrogate marker, just even in a very low-grade panin. Here you can see a normal acinar cells with the dot. You can also see it here better. But here you can see that now in these cells, now you don't no longer see dots. Now it's a strong dark blue, and the entire cytoplasm is positive. And obviously, when you go to a high-grade panin, the or PDA, the intensity of the blue is much stronger. So somehow, by a mechanism that we don't know how it happens, the expression of the KRAS is turned increases in the low-grade lesions. Whether this is a consequence of the lesion or actually this is what initiates the lesion. In other words, the first you have the increased expression of KRAS, and that leads to the formation of the lesion. Obviously, these are issues that remain to be resolved. Now, as in the model of Sunil and Dave, our mice develop pan-PDA, but they do not die. I mean, it takes by a year, there is only about 20% of mice are dead. If now we introduce a mutant allele, you already saw this yesterday from Dave, then the mice die faster, and then we see the same as he does metastasis, okay? So I just want to mention some unpublished data. This has been done in collaboration with Manuel Collado and Manolo Serrano, which identifies in these lesions senescence markers. As you know, a couple of years ago, there was a series of papers, including one from Serrano's lab, that linked the earliest stages of tumor development with a senescence phenotype. Senescence phenotype that is characterized by the expression of the endogenous beta-galactosidase. This is not the beta-galactosidase we engineer in the KRAS locus. This is the endogenous beta-galactosidase, which is a marker for senescence. And we see senescence in metaplasia. We see senescence in the low-grade panins. But then, as the panins become more advanced, in the panin 2, then some cases we see senescent cells, and other cases not. And in fact, only a few cells are express these markers of senescence. Panin 3 had always been negative. Here you have a slide in which you can see a 1B down here, and then PDA is also negative. And I'll get back to the senescence as a point of discussion later. Now, the beauty of the Cree system developed by Paul Grippe and Eric Sandgren is that is also you can control it in a temporal manner. The goal of my laboratory is to develop animal tumor models that mimic as closely as possible the natural history of human cancer. So I think it was already discussed a little bit yesterday. Pancreatic cancer is not a pediatric tumor. So we have to assume that the mutations that originate pancreatic cancer occur in adult people. So the model of Sunil and the one I just mentioned, they were the first ones to demonstrate is very, very important to reproduce the whole grade of panin lesions in a mouse as a model system, but has the caveat that the mutation occurs in embryonic development. And we are not sure, or we were not sure, what would happen if we would turn on the mutation in adult people, in adult mice, in the similar conditions that presumably happens in adult people. Now, with this system, we can now provide doxycycline in the drinking water to the mothers, and then this promoter will be turned off for as long as we want. In fact, we have now maintained mice in doxycycline, and there is no induction whatsoever or any detectable blue color. So, and then we can stop doxycycline anytime we want. So So it's a very, and it's not a leaky system. I mean, it really, really works very well. So what we decided to do is we had to, obviously, don't want to make these projects longer than necessary. So we decided to consider adulthood at 2 months of age when the mice become fertile. So to do this, then, we feed them with doxycycline in the drinking water, and then we stop feeding them. And then to our despair, we could not find any panines, okay? And Carmen has looked now to a lot of pancreas, and she has not found any panines, okay? So then there were obviously two interpretations. One is that the pancreatic cells, as they, the acinar and or centroacinar cells, as they became mature, they are no longer susceptible to transformation by KRAS, or alternatively that, I mean, which is the worst possibility, that the mouse may not be an appropriate model for human PDA, not in the sense that the lesions could not be reproduced, had already been shown by Sunil and Dave, but in the sense that we could not get tumors when the oncogene was turned on in adults. So at this point, reading a little bit the literature, I became aware of the relationship between chronic pancreatitis and pancreatic cancer. So we decided to modify slightly the protocol. That is, we fed doxycycline to the mice, but then when the mice were a month old, we start treating them with low doses of chronic cerulean, which, as you know, induces chronic pancreatitis. Now the doses are very, I don't have the numbers with me, they're very low, so the mice don't look sick at all. So I guess one can consider this subclinical doses. Then we continue doxycycline for until 2 months of age, and then we stop providing doxycycline so KRAS can be turned on. And then to our delight, what we found is a very rapid induction of panines. In fact, 1 month, only 1 month after the turning on the expression of the KRAS oncogene, then all the mice already have diffuse panine ones, low-grade panines. And then by 6 months after turning on the oncogene, already a fifth of the mice already had developed PDA, okay? This is just to show you that the PDA looks as the way it should look. So basically, we are still, we haven't had enough time to be able to really find out what the mechanism is, whether this is a consequence of the tissue damage that somehow restores proliferation, or probably this is part of the same, is a consequence of the tissue damage induced by the immune response. The fact of the matter is obviously all these lesions are full of neutrophils, macrophages, and lymphocytes. So in order to address this issue, we are now crossing with mice. I will get back to that later. But we haven't had really time to generate the strains. I will discuss, will tell you what we are doing right now. So the experiments I want to present you now are is ongoing work that, I think one of the main questions that came from the data I just showed you that was published a couple of months ago is that cerulean, that's the pancreatitis, had to be chronic. Or could we just have an episode, a temporal episode of pancreatitis, subclinical, that perhaps we don't even know that we had it, or at least it's not causing us a problem? I'm not an MD, so I don't know exactly how you feel when you have a limited episode of pancreatitis, and that might be enough to induce PDA. So we are now doing a series of protocols. The first one, we only expose the mice to 1 month with cerulean before the we turn on the oncogene. So this will be a case in which somebody has pancreatitis and then later gets, by an unlucky event, a mutation that turns on the KRAS oncogene. Now, in this mice so far, and all the experiments are now 6 months after turn it on the oncogene. We have found no pinene lesions, in this case, very mild atrophy, and some mucinous metaplasia, which I guess shows here. Now, if we change the protocol, and now we give cerulean after we have turned the oncogene, actually in this protocol, you could almost say concomitant with the activation of KRAS, we don't see much, but at least in 1 out of 4 mice, we already found pinenes, okay? So we just one month of treatment. If we let the KRAS oncogene to be turned on, we figured that the Cre, I mean, it takes time to cleave and so forth. So we let 1 month go by. So we let 1 month for the oncogene to be turned on in the pancreas. And now we treat with cerulean for just 1 month, okay? Now the situation is quite different because now we half of the mice already have pinenes. This is only 6 months. Obviously, the experiment is still ongoing. But we even see some high-grade pinenes in some of these mice. Okay, and this is just the 1 month treatment with cerulean. So I don't know to what extent this is a real severe or non-severe pancreatitis. You are the experts. So you have to tell me whether just 1 month treatment with cerulean is really a serious case of pancreatitis if this would happen in a human being or not. So, and now, as you can imagine, if we extend the period of cerulean treatment, again, not chronic, just 3 months, which is, I guess, about one-tenth the lifespan of a mouse, or less, now the situation becomes more serious, as you can imagine. Now, all the mice so far characterized as a sacrifice at 8 months, 6 months after turning on KRAS expression. They all have now low-grade pinenes and at least one high-grade pinene per pancreas. So far, no PDAs, okay? And I guess these are the pictures that show now that this is more significant atrophy and moderate inflammation and fibrosis. And these are some of the examples that Carmen has given me to show it to you, okay? So, in summary, expression of an endogenous KRAS oncogene, either in late embryonic or early postnatal acinar and centroacinar cells, or their committed precursors, induces the full spectrum of pinenes and PDA. So, I guess we already discussed this yesterday. So, chronic pancreatitis cooperates with KRAS oncogene expression in adult acinar cells to induce the full spectrum of pinenes and PDA. And now the new piece of information that I'm sharing with you is that short episodes of mild pancreatitis are sufficient to induce high-grade pinenes in adult mice expressing already KRAS oncogenes. So, and now I want to just show you something as a provocative set of data, and also to receive your comments, because we are still not sure what the meaning of this. This is data from Manuel Collado and Manolo Serrano that they allow me to present here. And this is an interesting observation, which, to be honest with you, I want to make sure that this is not a technological issue. They have looked for senescence in the low-grade pinenes immediately after the treatment with cerulean, okay? And then they have looked at mice that have passed 1 month later after the treatment with cerulean, so they have basically recovered from pancreatitis. And as you can see here, the beta gal, this is again the endogenous beta gal that is indicative of senescence, is very obvious, but here it is not. Now, this has two interpretations. One is that what cerulean is doing, or pancreatitis is doing, or the immune system is doing, somehow is bypassing senescence. Now, what I'm concerned, and in fact we're discussing this, is whether this might be a consequence of the condition of pancreatitis that somehow masks the reaction for beta-galactosidase. and I would like to hear your opinion. So, what are we doing now? Well, obviously, we are now crossing our mice with mice that are compromised for the immune response. And these are the mice that now we already have crosses. We're using the IgG beta flocks from Michael Kerin. This, we just got them from the Jackson lab with the COX-2 knockout, IL-6, and RAG-1. Because these are quadruple mutants, because the transgenic system has two alleles plus the KRAS, it takes over a year of crosses, okay? And then depending on the results, we will use inhibitors. I guess there is a paper in Cancer Research that was mentioned yesterday, recently showing some delay with COX-2 inhibitors. So, and then obviously we are open to any of your suggestions. So if I may, in the last 2 minutes, I would like to share with you a piece of information. This is all new data, is not published, that I don't know whether it is academic or not, but anyway, I want to show it to you because it may have some implications for the human condition. This is a system in which a single genetic event drives pancreatic cancer all the way, not only to PDA, but to metastasis, okay? We don't need here P53, P16, SMAT, one gene does it all. Now, which one is the gene? Well, you were right, KRAS. Now, this is data that stems from an observation made a number of years ago, actually 6 years ago, by Ming Yu, that actually the paper is very straightforward. The title is what is really provocative, that wild-type KRAS can inhibit lung carcinogenesis in mice. What Ming Yu did was to get mice from Tyler Jacks, the knockout KRAS mice, and heterozygous, because the homozygous, they don't survive, and just induce lung tumors with a chemical carcinogen. And he saw that the heterozygous mice were much, that the wild-type mice were more resistant than the heterozygous mice. So we extended these observations. We have generated a conditional KRAS. So we crossed the conditional KRAS with the model that you're already familiar with. So now we have the two alleles of KRAS targeted. In one case, expresses the normal protein, and in the other case, it doesn't, because it would express the oncogenic, and that would be embryonic lethal. So now these mice are perfectly fine. Now you give them CRE at the time you want, and now two things happen. In this allele, the stop sequences are removed, and now you express the oncogene plus my favorite color marker. And in the other allele, you lose expression of the wild type. Now, when we follow, this is not the adult expression, this is the embryonic, what we call the embryonic expression. These are the results that we got with the heterozygous mice. And then these are the results we got with the hemizygous mice, or what we call the LOH. This will be equivalent to an LOH. We see a little bit faster coming up PDA. And by year of age, all mice have PDA. So the disease progresses faster. But what is interesting is, and then they tell me, the pathologist and Carmen, they tell me that these PDAs are highly heterogeneous. I leave this for you because I obviously cannot make much of that, but I hope that this is the case. Now, what is remarkable is that these mice, they survive. They have a very similar survival curve as the heterozygous mice up to about 14 months of age. You can see here. But then, after this point, they start dying suddenly, where the others do not die. I mean, they die, but slowly. And then when we look at them, with Carmen look at them, they're all metastatic. So somehow, loss of the normal gene, of the normal allele, as found in this other model by Ming Yu a number of years ago, is sufficient to drive the whole process to metastasis. Again, I don't know whether this has a relationship with human disease. I don't know how frequent LOH, a loss of the normal allele, is in pancreatic cancer, but I thought it was an interesting piece of information to share with you. So in summary, loss of the wild-type allele concomitantly with the expression of the oncogenic allele accelerates the development of high-grade panin and PDA, okay? But what is more important is that these mice, unlike the heterozygous control, they start dying after 14 months of age, and these mice develop metastasis, okay? Now, the molecular mechanisms by which the normal KRAS protein delays, does not inhibit, but delays, I guess my use say inhibits, at the onset of cancer, PDA, we also observe this in lung tumors, by the way, and in this case prevents metastasis, obviously, as a mechanism remains unknown. We have been discussing this for quite some time, but with our concept of the biochemistry of RAS, it's difficult to come up with an explanation. So this is all I had to tell you. This work has been done primarily by Carmen Guerra, who's sitting here, also with the help of a graduate student, Alberto Schumacher, and thank you very much for your attention.
So thank you, Mariano, great job. I'd like to thank Ron Evans for forcing me to give this talk. He's wanted a filler for an hour, for 25 minutes, so he said you have to do it. There's been a competition going on here. Everybody's coming to the podium to say, I know nothing about pancreas. Even Neil Rosen said he knew less about pancreas than me. Well, I like to claim a gold medal on this area myself. My own interest in pancreatic cancer a little bit started out as a founder of a company called Cell Genesis, which is doing clinical trials in prostate cancer, but also did something with Liz Zaffi on the pancreatic cancer. And on the board, when I first heard them talk about it, I was stunned to hear the statement, 30,000 Americans will get pancreatic cancer, 30,000 Americans will die of pancreatic cancer. So that really, sorry, I'm going to start again. That really got us interested. So I have very little really to add to it, except we just began to get interested, particularly in the animal model systems, and thought that maybe some of the work we do with the viral vectors may be of some interest. And I learned a lot of things since yesterday, and I think they will be of some interest to many of you. What I like to do is to really present a case that we have been using viral vectors to make mouse tumors. And I'm going to give you an example from the one we have so far is glioblastoma, but you'll see some of it is going to be applicable to pancreatic cancer. And we just got, a few months ago, a grant from Nussgarten Foundation, a small grant to get started. So we just began to start, and you'll see at the end of my talk what we want to do with it. Part of it originates from the fact that animal models have been terrific. We learned a lot of things about them, but they have certain limitations. One limitation is, and you heard that repeatedly, that when you make a transgenic mouse, let's say with the RAS, or for that reason with the P53 or anything else, you basically have the gene turned on in every cell. Essentially, every cell in the liver that comes from that transgenic mouse or pancreas has that gene now mutated. Or for that reason, if you have a knockout of RB or P53, essentially every cell that comes out has essentially a knockout gene in it. And we all know that the human cancers, or in fact that's what we learned in cancers, do not start by the entire organ. There may be one cell which undergoes a mutation, perhaps acquires additional mutation, and over a period of time go on to become a cancer. On top of that, it has the immunological advantages because cancer cells don't grow among cancer cells. Usually they grow among normal cells. So the transgenic mouse models and other being very effective, despite what we learned from them, we thought that perhaps the viral technology we use of vectors may allow us to actually introduce the gene directly, maybe in one cell, in a whole tissue, and have all three, four altered genes at one time or turn them on in time, because the viruses can be used to directly introduce the genes. And that might add to recapitulate some of the human situation, we can really literally ask the question, can one cell in the background of the entire liver, for example, or pancreas, introduce three genes which are all involved in additive mutations can cause the disease. So that was really part of the thinking and the way, and I'll give you some example how we succeeded with that. So the idea is the following, that we will make a lentiviral vector, and I can tell you ad nauseum about lentivectors if you want to know, but I'll leave that for the time being. Just to take in my point that they work and we know how to do these things. So we can make a viral vector where we have a LOXP on a gene which blocks it but gives us an indicator. And only when Cre removes the LOXP can the gene of interest be turned on. So that's the starting point for us. So the gene could be RAS in this case, for example. And what we like to do, so here's an example. You can see when the gene is LOXP is onto it, you have the red gene, and if you add to it now the Cre, the red is gone. And more importantly now, the gene of interest is turned on because the Cre is turned on in every cell. And system is pretty tight. 95-99% of the cells are Cre out of it, and you can see most of the red is gone. So that's the argument that we think we have a vector that can do that. For molecular biologists, to be sure, yes, we can do it. You actually can make the protein, and it's almost entirely now following the Cre. So with that in mind, we asked the question, can we do some interesting stuff in glioblastoma? The reason we chose glioblastoma, partly because I didn't know much, we were not involved in pancreatic cancers, but the brain is very contained, and they're very defined regions. If you wanted to introduce the gene stereotactically, you could go in the directly into the hippocampus, you could go to the dentate gyrus, you could go to the substantial nigra, you could actually localize the region, and that was part of the interest we had, is to localize the number of cells where we want to introduce the gene. So that's what was the starting point for us for glioblastoma, not only because it's a terrible disease, but more offered a great model system for us. Now, I work very closely with Rusty Gage, who's across my lab, who basically taught us a lot of this stereo technology. What you can do is you can take a needle, have the virus directly introduced. In this case, for example, we do the hippocampus. You can almost see the needle, and here is the CA1, CA2, and CA3 regions. So you can do that directly where you want to do, and the amount of virus will dictate how many cells you can transduce. Again, I will not talk about, a big part of my lab is presently involved in Alzheimer's. And again, the example, if you introduce in a mouse which is transgenic for, in this case, amyloid plaques, you see the big plaques. If you now introduce a neprilysin which dissolves these plaques as a protease and which actually recovers the cognitive functions back, and again, I'm happy to talk if somebody's interested in that, and you can see there's a substantial reduction of the plaques. Again, in the hippocampus, because that's the virus can be introduced. So with that background now, the question we had was the following. We would like to take a stereotactic injection of a Cre-inducible lentivectors by introducing that in the brain, which has a GFAP Cre. It could be Nestin Cre. It could be any number of specific promoters which have a background of the Cre. So the idea is that the brain is gliofibrillary acidic protein promoter making the Cre, into which we will introduce the virus which has LOXP site, and we can ask the question where they will be induced. So here's the example. Here is the brain, part of the brain, GFAP positive. Here we directly introduce, in this case, a RAS virus, and you can see just those cells are now actually transduced where the GFAP Cre, the virus was injected. Because this is GFAP Cre, we are putting the LOXP lentivirus, LOXPs are removed, the Cre is now inducing from the LOXP and the gene is turned on. So the experiment is the following. What we really like to do, as I started out, I would like to have one cell in the hippocampus to introduce all three genes which are involved in this mutation. And we know in the case of glioblastoma, you need RAS mutation, AKT mutation, which is really the EGF receptor activation, and ideally, in the case, a P53 mutation. Those all three combined, in many of the cases, give you a full glioblastoma. So where do you want to inject it? Well, we chose neurogenic area where there's neurogenesis, because there's still some question whether you actually need neurogenesis or it's a dedifferentiation of astrocytes. So we introduce the gene directly, either into the hippocampus or in the subventricular zone, or in the cortex, or even in the olfactory bulb. So it, The idea was to do one cell, but we haven't quite succeeded there. But what we have gotten, in the case of the cortex, we have about 50 cells. In the case of hippocampus, we have about 40 cells. And you can see, again, direct injection into the cortex, direct injection into the hippocampus and the subventricular zone, just a few cells where the virus was injected. Again, we would like to go lower than that, but we haven't yet gotten. But still, it's pretty good to have only 47 cells that got the virus, that got the gene in the background of the whole brain, and in this case, the hippocampus. So again, you can see direct injection here. So we always have GFP as a marker for it. Don't confuse with GFAP. That's the glial fibric reticular protein. That's the promoter, only for the glial cells, but the vector has GFP in addition. And the RFP means the LOXP sites are not removed. Now you put into the GFAP mice, RFP is gone, and the gene is turned on. And again, as I said, in this case, there were 47 cells. So we have limited the number of cells. Now you could transpose, begin to think like that in the pancreas. You can introduce the gene very specifically just in a few cells if you're able to do that, rather than in the entire pancreas or the ductal cell or the acinar cells. Again, just to give you an idea, so here is the RAS. Here is the, in this case, I'll come back to the AKT, but you can see, again, the very cells, all the Cre is in GFAP positive, because in the nestin Cre, you don't have any similarity between the Cre and the nestin. Only when there's a Cre and a GFAP, there's an overlap of the sequences. So we know it's a very specific GFAP Cre mouse. If you took RAS alone, and it's known, we were just reproducing what others have done, there's absolutely no formation of tumors if you do RAS alone. And this has been shown by Eric Holland, that if you now combine them with activated AKT, and they used it in the neonatal mice, you can now take two genes. So now we have, in addition to RAS, we have AKT. So there is RAS, there is AKT, and there's a superimposition of the two. So all cells, we can either make one vector or we can use two vectors and co-infect in the same place. And now we have 5 out of 10, if we have RAS and AKT, which make tumors in about 136 days. So again, 47 cells in this case, or 50 in this case, containing RAS gene and AKT, RAS activated, AKT activated, in this case, myristoylated ATP, AKT, so it can go to the surface. The way we see the mice is, of course, the heads are elongated, so that's how you know the mouse is going to get a tumor, and you can see the tumors are large, and they're all GFP positive, because that is the gene we have always used as a tag, and you'll see that becomes interesting and important. They have all the characteristics, and again, I have no intention to go into the details of it, because that's the glioblastoma parts of people, but they have almost many of the properties of glioblastoma, and since there's a GFP positive, you can actually begin to see the movement of cells away from the tumor, and they will go on to metastasize, and you can eventually figure them out, because again, they're GFP positive. They started out GFAP positive, they are now nestin positive, they are RAS positive, they are AKT positive, and they are also dividing, but not as rapidly as I'd like to see them. And you can see the tumors very nicely. So they have many of the properties what one would expect. They are positive for high density, microvascular necrosis, but they do not have the nuclear pleomorphism or the giant cell that is very common in the glial in the glioblastomas. And they have a relatively low, although there was some Ki-67, but that was relatively low. And that's because they also require another mutation, and in this case, the P53. So we can do it two ways. Either we have Lenti, which is making siRNA to P53, or we can also directly inject it in a P53 heterozygote background. And when we do that, now, of course, it's actually very reminiscent of the slide we just saw from Mariano, where they do the KRAS and P53 in pancreas. But in this case, if you have now AKT, KRAS, and if you now have loss of P53, now nearly 100% of the animals come down with tumors. And now you begin to see necrosis, hemorrhage, and even the giant cell formation. So now, only when there is a RAS AKT, 11 out of 11, and some of them start at 4 months up to 10 months, every one of them has tumor. The reason I show this slide also is that one of the concerns for vectors, for viral vectors, is always, could it be the tumor is due to integration next to a oncogene or to an inactivation, a suppressor gene? It's possible. It's unlikely, because in many, many other cases, we have 0 out of 0. We don't think It's just due to the integration of the virus. It's probably due to the interaction here of RAS together with AKT in the background of P53 that we have 100% of them coming down with tumors now. In fact, we know it's every time 100%. They are now all the properties they have, including the nucleomorphism. So we think we now have encapsulated a situation where we can directly introduce two genes, knock out one, which are required to make a full tumor in just few cells in the background of the others. That is to say, you can now begin to ask the question, what normal cells might be providing for this because it is surrounded by the normal cell and not by the tumor cells. If we now just take the question of stem cells. Now, there was an interesting question yesterday about whether you have cancer stem cells, you have cancer-initiating stem cells. I believe it's hard to say because these guys are already prone to become aggressively growing because they already have a RAS activation, AKT activation, and P53, so it's not a surprise if you took these cells and put them back into the brain, they all grow again to become tumors. And in fact, 10 cells, in last case they were less than 10, actually injected directly into the adult mice, again you can see tumors are formed. So these tumors, which we saw with the P53 deletion, AKT and RAS, if you just take 10 cells, put them back into the brain, they make tumors. In fact, we don't want to kill these animals every time, it's expensive. We can actually do the gadolinium onto them and you can see very nicely the areas of tumors that we form. These tumors are, if you wish to call them cancer-initiating stem cells or stem cells, because they can replicate. They are like neurosphere structures. They replicate, they can go on to grow forever, essentially. There have been now many pathogens. And they differentiate at least into the glial lineage and into the neural lineage. We have a hard time doing oligodendrocyte as yet, and Rusty tells me that's generally difficult because you have to have some additional growth factors in order to make them to go to differentiate. But clearly, if you wish to call a property of a stem cell as a stem cell which can divide itself, proliferate, perpetuate, and differentiate into the lineage, these cells at least have the ability. So this type of tumor induced by virus direct injection, you have the ability to do that. The advantage, of course, is that if you want to add additional virus, if you wanted to mutate it, you can do all in the same in a relatively short period of time. Actually, not taking more time than what Daphne told us in vitro, it is a semi-in vitro situation, except you do in vivo, the results are much faster because you don't have to do crosses and breed them. They are CD133 positive, and they are highly vascularized. Have I taken 5 minutes? I think so. I was given 20 minutes, right? I've only taken 17. Unless you're bored. Brain tumor stem cells, they have the ability to be neurosphere, aberrant differentiation, and CD133 positive. Since they are GFP positive, we can track them. They are actually now spread all over the brain, and that's why it tells you if you now delete the tumor, 99.99%, the one or two cell left behind has the ability to make tumors again because they're presumably stem cells in this case. So then we begin to, since this is an ideal opportunity, we have a RAS activated, we have AKT activated, we have them together in P53, we can do microarrays in each one of them and ask the question, what other genes are actually important? So one of the genes that turned out to be very interesting and important is the Aurora A kinase, and you can actually see in the tumors we made, it is quite highly expressed. So we asked the question, what happens if we just put Aurora A kinase alone, along with the RAS gene? So I don't have to tell you Aurora A kinase, you heard that. Again, so now if we have Aurora A kinase along with the RAS gene, we make tumors. So we don't need now AKT, and in this case, we didn't even need P53. However, if you now, so you can actually see the tumor formed again. In the case of you now put P53, 100% of the time, we have KRAS and or Aurora making the same. So we can bypass some other because we already have it downstream. And again, the advantage here is that if you're looking for drugs against kinases, this may be an opportunity to consider because it's a downstream target because it's been difficult to deal with targets like RAS, for example, or even perhaps AKT. That's just to show the histology of it. So, one thing before I end, what we want to do with pancreas, we want to also know how do the tumors progress. So Mark Ellisman here has a wonderful microscopy where we can do two things. We can either do sections, or we can even take live animals. You can make a section in the brain hole where we put the gene. And since it's GFP positive, you can actually routinely do every few weeks or few months the same animal and ask the question how the tumor progresses. And one of the things we were interested in, because the tumor started out as GFAP positive, but in fact, the final tumor was actually nestin positive, GFAP negative. So we wanted to know, when did the transition occur during the development of this tumor? What genes are turned on, turned off, because we can mark them again because we are directly injected there. So work done together with Mark Ellisman. So here, you can again see here the cerebellum. Here is the hippocampus where we had injected. The tumor has begun to come. And you can see the tumor now here is neuron is green. Blue is the GFP as a marker. And the interesting thing is, in the first month, so this is not full tumors. They are not yet made tumors. They're still just going through the process. In fact, majority of the tumors are still glial positive. And only after another month, they will begin to become nestin positive. So we hope that we can actually look at the transition of the whole thing as the time goes by. Finally, we have, as I said, just got a grant from Lustarten. And what we want to do is really copy what David Chivison, Sunil, and also Ron DePinio have done. We just want to recapitulate their experiments in a viral vector to see if we can do these things. So we have vectors now, which has KRAS activated, and we have actually a microRNA where we can have three siRNAs simultaneously removed because we can then control their regulation. And so we have P53, P16 SMAD, and we have also now, we just got the chronic carbonic anhydrase promoter, which might make it specific. So we think this is a way for us to, we just began to do these experiments, so I don't have much to tell you about that. What I like to end up with is that even though I told you about glioblastoma, much of this thing we can begin to do in the case of the pancreatic cancers. For example, I heard yesterday a lot of discussion, what is the origin? Well, we can take one of David's KRAS transgenic mice, directly introduce into it a promoter which makes the Cre, and ask the question, do you make a tumor? They'll tell you whether it's an acinar promoter, it's a neurosinar promoter, it's an elastase promoter, or whether it's going to be a ductal promoter. So we can actually do the origin just by single injection into that. We can also begin to add two, three different genes and turn them out different time, because we have also tetracycline regulated both the siRNA as well as the transgene. So we think this kind of a technology may add to the kind of technology we have been hearing. They're somewhat faster. You can add additional mutations if you wish to add, and you can go very fast at it. There are clearly disadvantages of this technology. One of them, at the moment, we haven't been totally able to control the amount of protein that we make, although we began to use different concentrations of the virus. We can, I think, control it, but we don't as yet. We still can't always rule out the possibility of non-specific integration. And then, of course, there are demands on the amount of information that we can possibly add to these things, probably around 3 kb to 9 kb. And if there's something larger than that, we really don't have the information at the moment in the vector. So I thought it would be useful for you to hear a different way how we do these things. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Inder. I was asked to moderate and or facilitate this event, and I decided I'd actually look the words up. And it turns out that to moderate is to chair or preside over a meeting or discussion or to preside over a deliberative body. And I decided that was not going to work because there's not a cat in hell's chance, I don't think, of presiding over this group of people, since there's so many people here with opinions. So I then looked up facilitate and see what that meant, and it said to make something easy or easier to do. And that didn't seem very appropriate because it said easy to do is requiring little effort. And clearly you're all here because this actually requires a great deal of effort. There's a lot of thinking to be done. There's a lot of work to be done. It also said the second meaning was fluent but insincere. Produce, spoken, or speaking so fluently and easily as to seem insincere or superficial. And I'm sure you don't want to do any of that either, and you don't want us to do that. So I went for the third thing, which is the thing that we do over at the Science Network, which is that we don't really do meetings. We have what I like to call conversations. You've been doing that so well yesterday that I thought that I would encourage you as much as possible to continue doing that. And I don't know if you know this, but the Latin word, the Latin from which the conversation comes is conversare, which actually means to turn yourself around. So the idea is that you learn something, you rethink, and you move on. So I'm hoping that that's what will be achieved here, and that's what I'm hoping. I'm told that the Pancreatic Cancer Action Network is hoping will happen. So at this point, the other thing I would like to make a comment on, if I may, which is the discussion yesterday afternoon. I was sitting at the back when Jordan threw his small bomb into the proceedings, and I thought the discussion after that was spectacular, and I would like to congratulate you on it. I just was looking last night. I think a lot about the communication of science, and one of the things I'd like to discuss later, because we'll be doing this on Sunday, is this whole notion of not only getting the science down, but also how to actually use it to promote the requirements of the needs of this organization, and more importantly, of the patients who are suffering from this disease. It says in here that one of the things that they talk about is to say put emphasis on concepts rather than facts. I'd like to amend that slightly, if I may, at least suggest this. One of the things that we use at the Science Network is the old Daniel Patrick Moynihan quote, that everyone's entitled to their own opinion, but not their own facts. So I think the facts are hugely important, and it's great to see these facts coming out today. And the other thing that I loved in yesterday's discussion was the way in which people just said, I don't understand this. I don't know what we're dealing with here. And this goes back a long time. There was a well-known Islamic scholar called Al-Haytham or Al-Hazen, who said that the duty of the man who investigates the writings of the scientists, if learning the truth is his goal, is to make himself an enemy of all that he reads, and applying his mind to the core margins of its content, attack it from every side. He should also suspect himself as he performs his critical examination of it, so that he may avoid falling into either prejudice or leniency. So I think those are things that I saw coming out yesterday, and I'm delighted to be here. I encourage more of that. And what we're going to do now is to ask Ashok to comment on that.
Well, I...
comment on what Inda and Mariana already said.
I'm not sure I'm going to give a talk or even ask many questions. The aim is to facilitate questions, not to ask questions. So that's where we're going to go. But I think the opinions, as you mentioned, are not as important as probably facts. But I think opinions based on facts are the most important things. So we need to have opinions for sure, but they should be based on some facts. So just like Dr. Barbicid has presented his work, which, you know, maybe it started with opinions, but then he brought the facts with that, and that made it more scientifically relevant. So it was very, very interesting. Congratulations. That's something in the field of at least pancreatitis, where I've worked, and I'm now a little more in pancreatic cancer, that we really need connections between pancreatitis and pancreatic cancer. We know that not overwhelmingly the patients with pancreatitis and particularly chronic pancreatitis, but several or many do end up getting pancreatic cancer. The link between pancreatic cancer and pancreatitis is a little bit tenuous. It's not very strong right now, but I think your data certainly will be supporting that. So I think you have done some work with cerulean model. There are obviously several other models, most, as we can appreciate in most patients and then actually in animals also. We really don't have very good models for chronic pancreatitis. Cerulean is one of them, and it's more of a model for acute injury than chronic injury. So I think certainly we need many other models of pancreatitis with which we can, certainly proceed with your studies. And then another kind of, I want to throw a generic question in this. Is it really, in this case, inflammation or something coming from pancreatic injury? So how do we know it's really are the inflammatory mediators which you know, which are related to the genesis of tumor, and not injury to Eschner cells. Obviously, Eschner cells do make a lot of inflammatory agents, but Eschner cells, you know, have a lot of active trypsin, other active proteolytic enzymes, more so than many other cells. So Eschner cells in many ways are kind of unique cells because they have the capacity to destruct themselves, you know, by autoactivations. And we know that during pancreatitis, and particularly with cerulean for sure, there's a lot of autoactivation. So with that, I think let's open up the questions to the floor and see.
Yeah, I actually want. There are a couple of runners around. If you could do what you were beginning to do so well yesterday, which is to actually wait until the microphone gets to, because otherwise it just you'll be heard in the room, but it won't go on tape, so your colleagues won't be able to see it.
Seems like Ralph has the microscope up.
I do have a microscope, but right now it's a microphone.
When I think about Ralph, I always think about microscope.
Yeah, Mario, I want to congratulate you for beautiful work linking the chronic pancreatitis to pancreatic cancer. I think it's very elegant. I was struck that the lung neoplasms developed when you had the germline mutation in every cell in the body. And it got me to think, if inflammation is so important, as you demonstrate, are these animals infected with some sort of organism? Perhaps they develop pneumonia, and that's why the lung is the preferred site of origin. Have you done these in germ-free environment? And then I have a second question.
Yeah, this work is done in a barrier. And for the sake of the head of the animal facilities job, I assume it's germ-free. That was a joke. I mean,
they're not germ-free, unless you take extraordinary care.
They're not infected. So far, we've had 4 years of no incidents in the animal facility.
And then the second question, in the KRAS mutant with the wild type deleted, you suggested it was just KRAS driving neoplasia. Have you looked and shown that there aren't P16 mutations, P53 mutations, SMAD4 mutations accumulating as these animals age?
We obviously, what I meant, and I apologize if I didn't make myself clear, it was the initiating, I mean, that with that man-made mutation, it was sufficient to drive the whole process. I do not imply that these mutations do not happen. In fact, we are right now checking for SMAD4 deletions, P53 deletions, blah, 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 blah. We don't have the information. I wouldn't be surprised that these deletions happen. But what I mean is that we do not have to physically introduce these mutations just by eliminating the normal allele. The process goes into metastasis, whereas if the normal allele is there, at least in a 20-month period, we have not seen metastasis.
So can we go to Tony first?
I just had a follow-up on that, since we're on the subject, and that is that it's remarkable that you saw such progressive metastatic disease, and given in the context of the discussion yesterday that we had in our group on metastatic disease, it was a breakout session where we asked the question, why is pancreatic cancer metastatic so early in the process? It would make sense that KRAS contributes to that. I was wondering about experience in the other mouse models that are represented in the room with respect to the loss of heterozygosity for RAS in metastatic lesions that are observed in some of these. So has it been everyone else's experience that you actually do see this and that it is correlated with metastasis?
So we've actually seen probably in about 10% of the tumors using the system that we have that there is LOH of the KRAS locus. If the primary tumor has lost it, then you see loss of it in the metastasis as well, although in probably 90% of the tumors you can still see evidence of the wild-type allele in both the primary and in the mets. And then just to follow up, in our system as well, that David and I characterized, in the initial report, at the time of that report, there were only 2 animals out of the cohort of 29 that had succumbed to invasive and metastatic PDA. We now have followed the entire cohort, and greater than 90% of them actually developed primary PDA with metastatic disease. It was highly metastatic to the same sites that we had seen previously.
Ron Evans has been waiting for a second. Do you want to?
Well, the comment on Mariano's talk, I'm curious whether you think the macrophage infiltration is a key initiating event in the pancreatitis, and how much actual damage to the pancreas through sclerosis and other components is important to aggravate the disease.
I'm not an expert, so I don't like to make predictions. We just wait for the crosses to tell us what's relevant. One thing that I'm interested in testing is whether just overall infection, you know, I mean, a general immune response, not necessarily tissue damage to the pancreas, will also do the job. And this really stems from a comment that perhaps I didn't make it too clear, but I suspect that the reason why the panins came up in the mice with the long treatment with tamoxifen is because tamoxifen induces inflammation, not tamoxifen itself, but the vagal. So anyway, this is something to be tested in a more rigorous manner.
Well, we had a
manner.
Discussion last night a little bit about stellate cells in the liver, but there's also stellate cells in the pancreas. And one of the questions is, do they play a role in the disease, and do you have to overcome some effect or property of the stellate cell for you to progress towards either pancreatitis or towards pancreatic cancer? And I'm interested in what the people of the audience might think about the role of those cells in the disease itself.
I don't have anything Michael to say Cannon. About the stellate cells, but as refers to Ron's comment, I think that it's possible that this induction of beta-galactosidase that you noted after the chronic inflammation might be induction of a stress response, because the beta-galactosidase, so-called senescence-associated, is also induced by chronic stress. So I wonder if the chronic inflammation is inducing DNA damage, et cetera, and inducing your beta-galactosidase in those lesions.
Well, the experiment, as Manolo has done it, is he looked before cerulean treatment, then during or at the end of the cerulean treatment, and then 1 month after cerulean treatment. And what he saw is beta-galactosidase before the treatment, no or very low levels at the end of the treatment, and then recovery of the senescence 1 month after the treatment. So it's not, the question that I said I'm not still certain, and we are discussing this. In fact, we have a meeting on Monday to discuss this, is to whether the lack of detection of beta-galactosidase may be an indirect consequence of the pancreatitis and not a cell autonomous issue. And that I don't know. But it's clearly first is on, then it disappears, and then it's back on. So what his argument is that what cerulean is doing, or indirectly, of course, is to eliminate senescence. And that is what allows the papanins to progress. Obviously, once you remove cerulean, some panins will progress, and those will not express senescence markers once they go into panin 2 and panin 3, and others will re-express senescence, and they will remain as panin 1s or low-grade panins.
Karen,
that's the model.
Since cerulean, and actually the dose in your experiments is really whopping. It's a very overwhelming dose. You're using something like 200 microgram per kilogram, if you convert in that. At least that's what my calculation was, which is certainly a lot more than most of us use to induce pancreatitis.
No, my understanding, I don't know the number, my understanding is that we use a much lower dose than what you normally use to induce acute pancreatitis.
Well, I just quickly looked at your... Well, it could be. So I think looks like to me it's about 200 microgram, but maybe it's not that high. It depends where this cerulean come from and so on. It's variables. But one of the things maybe... what do you think if instead of cerulean, you have some other inflammatory mediator? Maybe just give LPS, a low dose of LPS. So would you get same kind of a thing?
That's the type of experiments I think we are going to do now.
And maybe a more relevant experiment for clinically more relevant for pancreatitis or chronic pancreatitis might be just, as you probably very well know that most patients who have chronic pancreatitis, they are because of, you know, overuse of ethanol.
So overuse of
alcohol. So maybe, and then there are models where you can induce somewhat chronic pancreatitis by feeding alcohol for several months.
Mice
will be very happy. I can assure you that. And particularly if they're going to get cancer, they might as well be a little drunk. So that might be.
No, that's a very good suggestion. I want to make one point that I did not mention, is that the combination of KRAS and tissue damage is not universal. We have induced colitis in these mice, and we do not get colon cancer. So somehow is, I wouldn't say it's specific, but at least it's not general.
Okay? Terry, do you want to continue that?
Yeah, okay. I have two questions and one comment about the colitis. So interestingly, I do ulcerative colitis-associated colon cancer, and RAS mutation is not part of that paradigm. And so maybe the reason you don't see colon cancer with colitis is because RAS mutation is not an underlying part of that tumor development. But to go back to your chronic pancreatitis mouse, have you looked at lipid peroxidation or other measures of oxidative injury? Okay, that might be something to do, kind of fun. And then the other thing, do your mice get diabetes?
I'm sorry?
Do your mice get diabetes?
We haven't looked.
Okay. Yes.
So,
well, we have a little bit of experience because we made once a mouse that was diabetic, but the animal caretakers may be different. Nobody has noticed it, and I do not go down to the animal facility. Unfortunately, I don't have time.
So unless
so that the answer is I don't know.
Unless this interrupts the flow, and please tell me if it does. I was going to go to Jeff Wall first. And then, Michael Caron, you had your hand up earlier. So we'll do that, and then Daphne, if we come to you afterwards.
So one question for Inder, and then one question for Mariana. Wake up, Inder. So, Inder, I want to get to this issue of stem cells. We were talking about it yesterday, and I think your data are very relevant to it. So you do an injection into the brain, and you hit 50 cells. And you get some number of them, possibly more than one, to contribute to a full-blown malignancy after introducing three genes. Now, in other tissues, I don't know about the brain, but the frequency of stem cells in the adult is extraordinarily low. So what your experiment would imply to me, and maybe you have a different interpretation, is that if you put the right combination of genes into any cell, that you can get a malignancy out of it, and then that cell can show some of the properties if the gene combination is right, that we ascribe to a stem cell. But the target is not a stem cell itself.
I thought I was pretty explicit saying that I don't know what is a stem cell. This is a cancer-initiating cell because it has all the three properties of the genes. Whether you wish to call it a stem cell, you can call it a stem cell, and that may be the true with all stem cells. It depends. They've already been activated in this case with all the genes that are needed to become self-sufficient.
But I mean, just
and in this case, because we happen to make them, so we know that's what happened to them.
I mean, just in probability. I mean, the probability of you hitting.
Oh, because we started from 40 cells.
Right.
95% of them actually made the tumor because they all got the same gene.
Right.
So it's not a surprise that 10 cells were sufficient to make a full tumor.
No, I
got
that.
Each of those cells, they're pretty much monoclonal, essentially. Each of those cells actually have all those three genes in it. So it's not a surprise. I would say, actually, I'll predict one cell will actually go on to make a tumor.
No, that's not the question. The question is the cell of origin. And if the cell of origin had to be a very special cell to begin
with. So in this case, we think the cell of origin is a GFAP-positive cell, which was nestin negative to start with. That was the cell of origin. Whether it was a cell which was dividing or whether it was a cell which then de-differentiated, I can't tell you. We will, because we have done the same experiment with retrovirus now. And retrovirus does not infect a non-dividing cell, and therefore the difference of the two will tell us whether it's a de-differentiated cell or a dividing cell.
Okay. And then, Mariana, I just want to get back to this issue that Thea was bringing up about this stress response. I understand your response to her, but It is conceivable that, although you presented an interesting interpretation that the cerulean is getting rid of the senescence and allowing outgrowth, there's another possibility, and that is that the other changes associated with senescence, changing matrix metalloproteases and alternative deposition of matrix materials, et cetera, are actually promoting genicity. So I'm wondering whether you've actually looked at some of those other changes, for example, that Judy Campisi would ascribe to the senescent state in vivo. Because I agree with Thea that beta-galactosidase itself is just a marker of stress.
So far as I know, Manolo Serrano has only looked at beta-galactosidase, but I will mention this Monday when we get together. Yeah.
So we'll go to Mike Karen.
So I have a few comments. First, the hydroxytamoxifen. I think it's the hydroxytamoxifen, not the vehicle, because we found that hydroxytamoxifen aggravates liver damage induced by carcinogens or carbon tetrachloride. And the way it works, it's actually, it's an estrogen agonist in some cells and it's an estrogen antagonist in other cells. And it antagonizes estrogen in Kupffer cells in the liver, and it exacerbates inflammation. It doesn't induce inflammation by itself, but it makes things worse. And there were actually trials to use tamoxifen in males to reduce hepatitis and liver disease, and they all failed because of that. So I would actually try to use other estrogen receptor agonists to induce CRE in these mice and see what you get, because it's not only responsive to tamoxifen. Now, regarding the suggestion to use LPS, that's not going to work because you need localized inflammation in the pancreas, and you cannot maintain systemic inflammation with LPS because animals become desensitized to LPS anyway. And I think Mariano's results show that you actually need quite long-term inflammation in that model, so you have to maintain low-grade inflammation for a long time. But it will be interesting to look at actually at markers of inflammation, at consequences of inflammation, which I guess you're in the process of doing. And the other interesting experiment would actually be to isolate cells in which you induce KRAS and try to transplant them into an inflamed and non-inflamed pancreas and see if an inflamed pancreas would actually allow the cells to become tumorigenic. And if you have a marker, you can actually see if the inflammation prevents senescence or prevent loss of mitotic activity. Mm-hmm. And because you really need to know what's the inflammation doing.
So,
yeah, these are very good suggestions. I appreciate
definitely. When they
just a quick remark. Is there a way to mechanically induce inflammation so you don't have to do it systemically?
So you can do duct ligation. Yeah.
Do you want to go ahead?
But by ligating the common duct.
Yeah.
But that will probably kill the animals sooner than later. They'll die from starvation.
You can actually ligate not the common duct, but the main duct.
Could you?
The pancreatic duct?
They
most likely will get very bad pancreatitis.
Yeah,
and week or two, they'll die.
Yeah.
So, do you want to make a point there? Or?
Yeah, maybe we can have an opinion for some other pancreatologist, Craig or Murray or Steve.
So, at the moment, Daphne, would you go ahead?
What was the question? It was. We were wrestling over the microphone here, so there a question that you wanted us to respond to?
Well, you can pose your own question. But we were wondering that if you ligate the pancreatic duct in a mice, would the mice survive for a long time or just a few days, or what will happen?
But then that's not.
I would wonder how would the food will be digested. That's the concern I would have. But I
can't address that. But I want to go back for a minute to this idea about the low-grade inflammation for a while, and the concept of stellate cells, because in my laboratory, Rosa Wong has been isolating stellate cells and looking at the effects of conditioned medium from stellate cells on pancreatic cancer cells. And conditioned medium from stellate cells actually increases proliferation, migration, invasion. So there are autocrine factors or paracrine factors coming from these stellate cells that are having major effects on the cancer cells. Furthermore, if you co-inject cancer cells with stellate cells into a mouse pancreas, you can get a tumor take at much lower numbers of the pancreatic cancer cells. So these stellate cells are not innocent bystanders. They're definitely having an effect. And when you have your long-term chronic inflammation, you're changing the microenvironment dramatically. It's a very different pancreas when you've got fibrosis than a regular pancreas.
So do you want to go ahead?
Yeah. I just wanted to start off maybe with a general comment, and then if I make it sufficiently succinct, maybe I'm going to have time to ask more specific questions. But I really think that the way the discussion is evolving brings up the point that if we want to engage in models or questions that relate to chronic inflammation and the development of pancreatic cancer, and probably it applies to any other organ, we have to maybe change the way we deal with the word inflammation and really start characterizing subtypes of inflammation. And I don't know if it's going to be sufficient to do it only by cell types that exist, by the cell infiltrates, or what criteria we're going to be using to actually say that an organ is chronically inflamed. And I think this is what Ashok maybe have been referring to. Because to me, it does look that we are relating now to inflammation the same way maybe we related to tumors 30 years ago, where you looked at it as a mass and you said it's a tumor, and now we know it consists of many other things. And so I can tell you that from our experience, for example, as some of you may know, we have tried to model hereditary pancreatitis in the mouse, and that gave us some results. And from there on, what we notice is that you can induce chronic inflammation by many different means. It can be diet, it can be alcohol consumption, it can be all sorts of things. And the inflamed pancreas looks very different with each one of these inflammation-induced agents. So really, if we want to seriously ask the question, what is the link, there has to be an effort, might be not very sexy, might be quite boring, but someone has to type these different modes of inflammation.
I hope. I mean, I'm totally new in this field, but that with the crosses, with the various mutants we cross, and probably there are others we should cross, at least that should help to delineate whether it's the adaptive response, is the innate response, or what cell type it is. I mean, it's going to take time, because just only to generate the mice, it will take a long time. Perhaps with other approaches that are bypass the need of doing all these crosses will be done in a faster way, but I think that's the way. I think the genetics are very important in these issues.
I would like to kind of caution you a little bit on that when you have these crosses and you make the mice with the different cytokines, chemokines, knockouts, that there is a really redundance of these pathways in pancreatitis. I mean, there are tons of them, and you can knock down one, the other will compensate. So don't get very disappointed if one or two of your knockouts don't work. So continue.
We are used to.
Actually, I don't know. We talked a little bit about, and you talked about COX-2 and then its effects. I would like to recognize Dr. Howard Reber. He was right there. I don't know where he is right now. We mentioned about the paper which came out in Cancer Research. That's his work, and then he's one of the you know, eminent pancreatic surgeon in Southern California. There comes Dr. Reaver. So we've been talking about his work yesterday and today, and I thought it's very appropriate that we should recognize him. And he's one of the more eminent pancreatic surgeon in Southern California.
Very good. So I just wanted to add one more thought that I think might help maybe for us to think about this issue of injury versus inflammation, and that is that there is something... I don't know, maybe the inflammation experts in the crowd can comment, but I found quite unique about the pancreas, and that is that when you get tissue injury as a result of inflammation, in our hands, it's never associated with apoptotic cell death, but always associated almost exclusively with a necrotic cell death. And whether necrosis has a very different impact on the parenchyma as opposed to apoptosis might really be something that is fundamentally different about the pancreas. So we were actually quite shocked when we did our staining for, we assumed that at least we're going to see some cells dying of apoptosis. So this is just really something for us to think again as we try to think about the crosstalk between the parenchyma and the inflammation.
And then it's
one of the questions I just wanted to respond to your... Using this kind of vector that I described, we actually are planning to do to induce NF-kappa-B activity specifically in a specific cell type.
And
ask the question,
I'm sorry, but you need to get
close to mine. What kind of lymphokine cytokines that turn on each cell type, because they are major pro-inflammatory molecules, so we can actually do that in a much faster way. That's part of our plan to do that, along with the RAS activation, is to use P65 activation or IKK2 activation.
Yeah, I just want to first of all compliment both Inda and Mariana. Those were really amazing presentations. And Mariana's paper, I think, was illuminating in so many ways to people working in the field. I think this conversation about exploring other mechanisms to induce inflammation is really critical, so that when we give cerulean to mice, we can activate nestin expression in dedifferentiating acinar cells within 48 hours. And so I think that that model is characterized by a confluence of acinar cell autonomous and non-autonomous effects that are going to be difficult to distinguish. And so some of these more specific models of inflammation, I think, are going to be very informative. I think they may require the type of mosaic or heterologous combination analysis that Michael just proposed, and that Inda's model facilitates, that Daphna's in vitro models may facilitate. And I want to just call emphasis to the fact that many of the mechanisms by which inflammation is induced in the pancreas have profound and rapid effects on acinar cell differentiation prior to any visible initiation of inflammation. And then the question I had, Mariano, is that many of us in the audience have seen the induction of Pannin lesions in adult animals based on activation of KRAS in acinar or centroacinar cells without the requirement for additional extrinsic initiation of inflammation. So I showed some data with the elastase Cre ERT2. Charlie Murtaugh has similar data. I think Sunil has data. Craig Logsdon has data. Your data are incredibly compelling, and I just like to explore the potential explanations for this apparent differential dependence on induction of inflammation.
Well, one possibility is what I interpreted as indirect inflammation, and now Michael says that may be a direct effect of 4-hydroxytamoxifen. At least that might be in your case.
So we give tamoxifen for 1 week, 5 days at 60 days of age, and the very first Pannins we see are at about 4 months of age. So I suppose you imagine that brief an initiation of an inflammatory response might.
I don't know. I mean, because the number of Pannins you see are how many per mouse? I mean, is that just one per mouse that we might have missed, or you're talking about 10, 12 per pancreas?
It's, it's more than one. We haven't formally quantified it. Sunil, have you quantified pannin formation in the elastase Cre context?
Dave, could you hand the mic over?
We haven't used the inducible form of elastase Cre. We've used the inducible form of PDX Cre. And we think you can see in that setting quantifiable increase in pannin formation. The other caveat to all of this, though, is that you know, you do often see small amounts of local injury inflammation, those kinds of cycles that are going to take place as well in the pancreas. And whether or not that, you know, talked about the subclinical level of injury, if we go even lower than the type you've described, perhaps that's contributing.
I mean, I don't know whether your Mars facility is barrier also is pathogen free. Is it?
As is yours.
Okay.
so we have just a couple more that we can do. We go to Mark Kors first, and then and Neil Rosen's been sitting patiently, amazingly.
So I have a couple of comments and a question. And one comment is exactly what you said in terms of cell autonomous effects. Thanks for saying that. You said it more elegantly than I could have. Second comment is, Mariano, you may not know a lot about chronic pancreatitis, but your first author does. I looked it up in the paper, and she did use a very low dose of cerulean, about 5 microgram IP.
Thanks. That's what I thought.
So that's what it says in this paper. And then the third comment is the work that we did with the Nestin Cre mouse model, which dies at age 6 to 8 months. And the reason it dies is it gets CNS lesions. And we thought, oh, gee, it's getting brain tumors. But it turns out it gets these obstructive lesions, which we don't understand. We're trying to figure out. And they get hydrocephalus. We've looked at other parts of the body. The first part we looked at was the lung, because I still remember your seminal lecture 20 years ago in Washington, D.C., where you unveiled the role of KRAS mutations in lung cancer. And we don't find any lesions in the lung. We don't find anything significant. 1 in 5 or 6 mice get large spleens. So we thought, oh, maybe they're getting lymphomas. But our pathologists say, no, that's perhaps something, but it's not a lymphoma. The liver doesn't get any changes. And the kidney is occasionally enlarged and occasionally looks like it has some cysts in it. So why am I saying that? We emphasize the fact that lung cancer has a high incidence of KRAS. I mean, pancreatic cancer has a high incidence of KRAS mutations. But the flip side of it is also true. When you express mutated KRAS in something that's really found in many, many cells in the body, the pancreatic stellate cells are rich in Nestin. The nervous system is rich in Nestin. Endothelial cells are rich in Nestin. The only place where we get actually pannins and pannin progression is in the pancreas. So the flip side, not only is KRAS mutated in pancreatic cancer at a high incidence, but the pancreas is very sensitive to mutated, constitutively active KRAS, much more so than any tissue we've looked at. So do you have an explanation for that?
I wish we had. I mean, that's, as I told you, we did this experiment to find out. Because until we were able to make these mice, our universe centered around something called NIH3T3 cells, which certainly I'm very thankful to them, but you know, it's only limiting. So that's why we did this experiment, to see where KRAS, because in humans you only see what becomes mutated and not what is actually functioning. So I think we're still a long way to go to really understand why. But KRAS is very, very transforming in lung cells, actually in Basque cells or the type 2 pneumocytes or whatever, but not in Clara cells, if I understand. So cell type is really, really important for oncogenes, and this is something we all agree to this. I guess in many years ago, we just thought that anything transformed 3T3 cells should transform everything else.
So the final comment is in relation to Steve's experiments with tamoxifen. If you give tamoxifen, the effect lasts for 48 hours if it's a one bolus kind of treatment. But if you give it repeatedly at high doses, then you may bring in the inflammatory changes and who knows what other changes, because the it's a selective estrogen receptor modulator that has effects on any cell that expresses estrogen receptors.
So, final comment. We're actually running a little late, so there's a 15-minute break coming up, and then we go come back to Ron Evans. But final comment. I hope this is not a provocative. I hope this is a nice summary comment from Neil Rosen.
Not a provocative comment. We just spent 25 minutes or so discussing how to make the proper inflammation model. Most pancreatic cancer is not associated with clinically obvious chronic pancreatitis. So my question really to Terry and Ralph and anybody else who knows about this, which I don't, is do we think the vast majority of pancreas cancer that does not occur in the presence of chronic pancreatitis is occurring because of subacute or subclinical pancreatitis, or do we need non-inflammation models? So my other question, my challenge question there is, I would have thought, and maybe Daphna already put cold water on this, I would have thought that alcoholism would be a much greater risk factor for pancreatic cancer if it was just inflammation, since that's the best way, at least in my own personal experience, of causing intermittent pancreatitis or gallstone disease or some other things that cause intermittent subclinical pancreatitis. So I don't know if that's...
So actually, alcohol...
Well, you need a mic, Mark. Or else...
I know. That's my point. So should we be looking for a Tugesson model that does not need inflammation as a real model?
Could we could actually revisit the inflammation question and go back to Terry again after the break, because the inflammation stuff is carrying on after.
Well, when...
Do you want to answer it now? Quick. Okay, why don't you answer it now?
If I make a very quick clarification, I mean, one thing we have to keep in mind is that these mice get PDA with inflammation, but they have KRAS expressed in 30 to 40% of their pancreas. In a human being, probably the mutation of KRAS in the pancreas is not so frequent, and even when it happens, it's only going to happen in one or two cells. So that's I mean, just want to make clear that we cannot think that everybody who gets some inflammation is going to get pancreatic cancer, because you have to have KRAS. And probably having KRAS is not so, thanks God, it's not so frequent. Just a brief
comment. Alcoholism is more frequent.
Right, good.
You know, final comment.
This is incredibly provocative area, and I think it's a really interesting area to talk about, is this chronic inflammation. I believe that, so chronic pancreatitis is, as a GI doctor, you know, I can just speak a little bit to this. Chronic pancreatitis is very difficult to diagnose. And the way it comes to our attention is people have symptoms. And so then we go on and make that diagnosis. They have pancreatic insufficiency or they develop pain. But the truth of the matter is that we don't have any good biomarkers of pancreatitis, chronic pancreatitis. So the problem is that there probably is quite a bit of subclinical pancreatitis that is undiagnosed. And these people would have marginal symptoms or maybe even no symptoms, and yet we don't have any biomarkers to measure the fact that there's a chronic inflammatory process or chronic fibrosis or chronic injury to the pancreas. And so another issue that sort of has been arising is every pancreatitis the same? And so we were talking yesterday, I was talking to Ralph about the fact that there's sort of a general rubric of how we describe fibrosis in the pancreas and pancreatitis as being sort of synonymous, and in truth, maybe they're not. And that goes along with the idea of, you know, does every injury caused to the pancreas, is it all equal? So if we cause injury from alcohol, is it equal to the injury we see from chronic lipidemia? And so what I would propose, and Howard has another proposal, but what I was going to propose, I feel like we're kind of where we were when we first described the mouse models of Pannon lesions. I feel like we have not histologically explored pancreatitis and I don't like to call fibrosis of the pancreas pancreatitis. I mean, maybe there's something wrong with me, but it seems wrong to me. Seems like a nomenclature. You're jumping to the conclusion that there's chronic inflammation and oxidative damage. So what I was going to propose is, because Ralph's not doing anything, I was going to propose that maybe we should do sort of a more structured study of pancreatitis, actually assess the oxidative injury, assess histologically what you see, and try to get our handle on, you know, what kind of a role is this playing in pancreatic cancer. As you say, not everybody with chronic pancreatitis has a RAS mutation, but the frequency, you know, I think the frequency of chronic pancreatitis far exceeds the frequency of pancreatic cancer. So if you take all those people with chronic pancreatitis and you give 10% of them a RAS mutation, maybe that is the number that we should be looking at. So, Ralph, do you want to say no?
So can we...
I was going to make a comment that when we discussed pancreatitis alone, we had similar discussion and a lot more. And we have pancreatic cancer alone, we have fairly robust discussion as we saw. And here we are combining two very controversial and complex diseases. Right. So it reflects in the discussion very well today.
Yes, and thank you for the discussion. And can we come back here in about 15 minutes for Ron Evans? Thanks.